This episode is brought to you by Google Chrome. You think you know a browser, but Gemini and Chrome? That's new. It can help you with practically anything on the web, like restoring a vintage motorcycle from a 50-page restoration blog, or finally break down that long article you've had open for weeks. Gemini and Chrome is here for it. Ready to make anything online make sense? There's no place like Chrome. Check responses, setup required, compatibility and availability varies 18+.
This is Climate One. I'm Ariana Brocious.
And I'm Greg Dalton with a special bonus episode of Climate One. Here in the West, wildfire season has begun. In California, tens of thousands of acres have already burned this year.
In last week's episode, we took a deep dive into how individuals, communities, and governments can build resilience and re-examine their relationship with fire. Today, we focus on California. The Golden State recognizes indigenous communities have a long history of living in balance with wildfire. Now, government officials are asking to learn from them.
It's so remarkable when you spend time with tribal communities in California, the intimate knowledge that they have of how to steward these lands.
That's California Natural Resources Secretary Wade Crowfoot. His agency covers a ton of ground. It manages the state's public lands, parks, wildlife, and the state's firefighting agency, CAL FIRE.
During San Francisco Climate Week, Climate One hosted Secretary Crowfoot in conversation with KQED science reporter Danielle Venton. They talked about the state's current approach to wildfire.
Wildfire is a natural part of our ecology in California and across the American West. The big challenge is this unnatural, catastrophic level of wildfire that we're experiencing in California. You know, before California was a state, when Native American communities were stewarding our lands, they had established a lot of low-level prescribed fire, cultural fire onto the landscape to manage this. California statehood comes on. That practice is actually prohibited. There's misunderstanding of a lot of our natural resource professionals over almost a century to try to exclude fire from our landscapes. And then when we add on climate change, which means hotter temperatures and less healthy forests, we have this epidemic of catastrophic wildfire risk. In the last 5 years, 7% of our state has burned. And most of that has been catastrophic wildfire that's threatened communities and also essentially charred landscapes. Now, we know that there's a lot that we need to do and there's a lot that we are doing. And fundamentally, it's about restoring health to our landscapes, whether it's forests in Northern California, the shrub chaparral in Southern California. So it involves a couple things. One is our firefighting entity under our agency, CAL FIRE, is the most sophisticated in the world. So we're doing more to respond to fires and keep them small. We're doing more to take action upfront, proactively. That's where wildfire resilience comes in. Our governor and legislature, $3 billion of funding over the last 3 years alone on these projects, whether they're fuel breaks around communities that allow wildfire firefighters to take a stand, or whether they're reducing the density of vegetation or reintroducing that prescribed fire. We have a target to hit 1 million acres of these projects with the federal government by 2025.
The last 2 years, we've had relatively light wildfire seasons. How much do you attribute that to the weather and good luck? And how much do you attribute that to the investments that the state has made?
Yeah, it's a really great question. So, you know, when Governor Newsom came in, when, you know, right after he was elected was the Camp Fire that destroyed Paradise and took almost 100 lives of Californians. Mm-hmm. And then the next couple of years were brutal. And that coincided with the driest three-year period in the state's history. I am really thankful, one of like two really solid water seasons and then two moderate seasons. I think, look, a lot of it is Mother Nature. You know, what we know about climate change is that there is variability, but the trend can't be denied. And at the same time, we are seeing these investments work. So over the last couple of years, we've tracked wildfires that were in danger of becoming very large. And once they reach a certain, you know, size and temperature, they're basically making their own weather, and there's very little that you can do, you know, through firefighting. Well, what's kept a lot of those fires small are some of those proactive projects, those prescribed fires, that vegetation thinning, those fuel breaks. And so there's numerous fires over the both of the last fire seasons that we can point to that have actually been smaller as a result. We also, you know, the budget of CAL FIRE has doubled under this governor. So we're attacking fires more quickly. I'm really excited, though, that CAL FIRE is also getting more prescribed fire onto the ground than it ever has, partnering, learning from California tribes. That's a really key part of nature-based solutions, is bringing in this traditional ecological knowledge of our tribes. And we've purposefully, you know, over a century, disconnected ourselves from this knowledge. So even if we have a good fire season or a good water season, we recognize that, you know, as scary as this is, the last decade could be the best decade of our lives as it relates to climate impacts.
Worrying. I do think that empowering Indigenous and Native people and paying attention to some of that traditional knowledge, this has been one of the most compelling stories related to wildfire of our time. What is the state doing to bring Indigenous people, Native people to the table and empower them to restore some of those old practices?
Yeah, this is something that is probably among the most meaningful of the work that I get to do. And that is, you know, having this whole journey of reconciliation with our California tribes. You know, the first governor of California in his inaugural address put a financial bounty on the heads of Native women and children, paying Californians to kill women and children. That is state-sanctioned genocide. And Governor Newsom acknowledged that when he was in the first few months of his term to invite tribal leaders of Sacramento and issue a formal apology. And that was a powerful moment, probably the most powerful, you know, day of my career. But what we all recognized and the tribal leaders told us is if that's all you do, ultimately it's counterproductive. We have to then lean in and follow through. So in our agency, it looks like ancestral land return. It looks like binding co-management agreements for our resources. It looks like actually integrating traditional ecological knowledge into our scientific climate assessment. And we're doing it. You know, our governor, our legislature, 2 years ago allocated $100 million for ancestral land return to help some of California's tribes that have been dispossessed of land, don't own any land since they were dispossessed over a century ago, actually getting land back. So I'll always say I'm proud of our progress with a lot more work ahead in this area.
A lot of the people who I talk to who really care about prescribed fire say that prescribed fires aren't going to get us to where we need to go in terms of, you know, the number of acres that need to be treated, and that we really need to start looking at allowing fires, you know, when it's safe and when it's managed and when it's been prepared for, allowing fires that are doing ecological benefit on the land to continue to burn with a plan to protect communities,
yeah,
and infrastructure and valuable property and stuff.
Yeah.
How is the state thinking about that?
Yeah, it's a great question. So managed fire, the idea if you have a fire in a remote area, rather than, you know, focusing your energy and putting it out, letting it burn, is, you know, has been controversial in rural California. Because if you're a small community and you're worried about that fire, you're very concerned that the firefighters are more interested in sort of letting the fire do its thing than protecting your community. But I think we've made a lot of progress. We know that low-level intensity fire is healthy for landscapes, and that's why we do prescribed fire. We know that some of the wildfires that are generated in California, many naturally through lightning strikes, ultimately burn themselves out. Last year, in far northern California, there was a lightning complex of fires, which means lightning started a lot of different fires. And ultimately, the Forest Service monitored it very carefully, but I would say largely managed that fire for ecological benefit. And they did it effectively, away from communities and with the support of tribes that were actually seeing that that was the type of fire. So I think that there's a role for differentiating low-level fire from big catastrophic wildfire. You know, to date, we've only had one metric of fire, and that's the acres burned. And we need different metrics. We need that, you know, metric for, you know, prescribed fire, but then lower level fire that's not unsafe for communities, you know, so-called beneficial fire, and then that catastrophic wildfire. And if you drive up the Route 50 to South Lake Tahoe and you see the burn scar of the Caldor fire, you can see the differentiated fire. In some places, the fire burned fairly low severity. And there you see A lot of the understory, you know, cleared out, but the mature trees are still green and growing. And then in other areas, you'll see the whole place just looks like nuclear winter. So, you know, we think that there is a role to get a lot more sophisticated about differentiating these fires and then ultimately getting to a point where you have low-level fire, whether that's naturally occurring or prescribed, you know, on an annual basis.
Wildfire safety, you know, isn't just about the forest and the forest being prepared for fire. It's also about communities being prepared. Right now, we have a lot of local control in how communities are built or are rebuilt after fire. What do you think we need to do to encourage communities to be more safe, to rebuild more safe, and maybe in some places not rebuild if it's too dangerous?
Yeah, this is a point of tension in California because it's been counties and incorporated cities and towns that define the way that they grow. And there's been a real, you know, opposition and concern around sort of land use planning on a local basis, you know, dictated out of Sacramento. So we understand that. At the same time, we understand that protecting people requires minimum standards. So for example, ensuring that there are routes of evacuation from communities, if a fire is bearing down on one side or the other, that there's defensible space around homes, that there is places of refuge within communities if there's no places to go. So the state does have authority to create, update, and enforce those standards. So it's a dynamic process. I mean, I will say that there's a lot of work happening across the state in these communities to make them what we call fire wise. It's not about excluding fire from their regions. They know that fire is inevitable, but how do you actually live through fire? I don't think it's going to get to a point where Sacramento is dictating every last decision out of the counties or cities, but certainly in everyone's benefit, you know, first and foremost, the residents, the state does have to set certain standards that protect life and safety.
Are there codes you'd like to see changed?
Well, there's codes that are being discussed right now, and that's, you know, the level of defensible space. What are the standards for building communities or rebuilding communities? That question of access and egress, you know, where you're allowed to build in the topography, et cetera. And so those conversations are not easy because, of course, you know, the counties are really focused on building more housing, but they're ones that need to happen. And they're happening through what can feel like a lengthy process, but it's a transparent regulatory process. So, everyone's interests and voices are heard.
How can we solve the home ignition problem by incentivizing home hardening, such as Class A fire-resistant, ember-resistant roofs to save our trees and forests from being cut down?
Yeah, so home hardening is a really important solution that I didn't talk about, and that is essentially...
And I think maybe we can define the home ignition problem is the problem that most homes burn down, not from the fire coming at them, but from embers getting in and burning the house down from the inside.
Absolutely. And in some cases, you know, the fire moving from house to house. And in Paradise, you know, there are houses that are standing, but there are the modern houses that were built after a time when we had these home hardening standards. So the good news is our new buildings have these strong standards. But the reality is that, you know, well over the high 90s of our houses don't have those standards. So then the question is, how do you help people actually harden their homes? We are excited to pilot an interesting program with FEMA around home hardening in communities that have been impacted by wildfire. There's so-called hazard mitigation funds that FEMA gives to communities to ensure that, you know, they're more resilient to a tragedy like that again. So there's some of that that's happening. We're also thinking about, you know, other ways that we can provide incentives, much like you provided for solar on rooftops for home hardening. You know, ultimately, 25% of Californians live in these high hazard severity wildfire zones. And there's nowhere near that portion of California homes that have the home hardening. So it's public education. It's these community organizations like these FireWise communities, fire safe councils that are educating. And then, you know, we're continuing to explore what incentives that we can provide.
Hi, Diva. It's Rachel.
And Jordan. Yeah, hi. Quick question.
Why are you not spending your Venmo balance?
Yeah, we're concerned.
You can, like, buy stuff with it.
Ugh, you love buying stuff.
And earn cash back on eligible purchases.
You love purchasing eligible things.
So the money your friend sent you yesterday, that's today's ramen, or rideshare, or eye patches.
The skincare kind, not the pyro kind.
Spend with Venmo, and you can earn cash back with Venmo Stash. Venmo Stash bundle terms and exclusions apply. Max $100 cash back per month. See terms at venmo.me/stash terms. ID verification required to use a Venmo balance.
That was California's Natural Resources Secretary Wade Crowfoot speaking with KQED's Danielle Venton.
This special episode was supported through the Wildfire Strategies Program of Resources Legacy Fund. Thanks for listening.